This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Cosmetic injectables aren't just beauty treatments. They involve some powerful prescription drugs like Botox and neurotoxin that can cause serious harm if misused. And the market here in Australia is booming. And it's worth billions, but new national guidelines and a patchwork of state laws have made the rules complicated. Well, joining us is Chris Rudge, lecturer in law at the University of Sydney, to try and make some sense of it. Chris, welcome to Drive.
Thanks, Warren.
When someone books in for Botox, what are they really signing up for? And how different is it from, say, just another salon treatment?
Well, Botox and other dermal fillers are prescription-only medicines. So you are signing up for the administration of a medicine. You're not just going to get a haircut. And so, as you suggested, Botox is actually very dangerous in the wrong quantities. If there was an overdose, it can lead to some significant health threats like botulism. So you are signing up to the professional standards of the therapist or of the practitioner.
How does it work? How does Botox work?
It damages the nerves in the skin, so it effectively causes the cells to die, apoptosis. So it doesn't want to be used flippantly, and you should have a very well-regulated and trained person administering it.
Chris, how do you know if someone is trained appropriately?
Well, the new guidelines that have come in from the professional regulator for the health profession, APRA, have made it mandatory that no nurse practitioner, registered nurse or enrolled nurse, and usually it's nurses who are administering the treatments after a medical practitioner has given the prescription. The new guidelines make sure that no nurses enter into the cosmetic sector until they've done 12 months of general nursing practice, which is quite a big step. So that means that inbuilt into that is the presumption that nurses will, in their general first year of practice, learn from others how to do things like administer, kind of injections, and that training will kind of automatically make them more, experienced by the time they are in the kind of cosmetic treatment clinics.
Chris, do we see many overdoses in Australia of Botox?
We don't. So it's quite rare, but there was one earlier in this year in New South Wales. In fact, there were three or four people who suffered the symptoms of botulism. Now, interestingly, with that one, it wasn't from a kind of clinic, and there wasn't a registered health practitioner administering the Botox. That was from a completely layperson administration of the product, and I'm not sure where it was obtained from, but it was effectively a Botox party. Unfortunately, for people who aren't registered practitioners at all, who might get their hands on Botox and kind of take it upon themselves to offer it to others, there's no way that the professional regulations can actually discipline someone like that because they're not a professional. But in those circumstances, the state poisons laws will kick in, and someone who possesses Botox without an authorisation will be subject to penalties.
We're chatting with Chris Rudge from Sydney Law School about the confusing legal patchwork that governs Botox and cosmetic fillers in Australia. Chris, does the same sort of risks apply to other cosmetic fillers as well, or is Botox one of the riskiest?
Well, Botox is extremely popular and common, so I think that is just one of the ones that, led to the review, which is, why these new guidelines have been established. It was a long 2-year review into what's called the non-surgical cosmetic sector. But there are other treatments involved here. So you've got things such as chemical face peels, dermabrasion, even, you know, hair transplants. All of these kinds of non-surgical cosmetic procedures are covered by the new guidelines.
A friend of mine had a treatment recently and it went horribly wrong and his face was almost like burnt for several months and he was in a lot of pain.
Absolutely. I've seen in the case law, there are people who sue practitioners for negligence when they end up with these kinds of results. And especially some of the light-based kind of therapies that, you know, can be beneficial for skin rejuvenation. If they're not administered well, they can go the other way and can create long-lasting and hopefully not, but definitely possible permanent damage.
Chris, some states require doctors to show there's a therapeutic need before prescribing. How does that apply, I suppose, when the purpose is purely cosmetic?
Yeah, it's a good question. Cosmetic products are not necessarily just because they're cosmetic, not therapeutic. In fact, there's a whole emerging literature on the fact that some people who use cosmetic products have extreme therapeutic benefits, such as improvements in mental health and all the rest. But technically, if you look at, you know, the fact that Botox, for example, is registered as a medicine with the Therapeutic Goods Administration, if you look at the pamphlet and the information sheet accompanying the registration, you see all of the indications. This is what Botox is registered for, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If any of those indications, if something other than those indications is the purpose for which it is used, then you might say, well, that's not therapeutic because it's not something that the product manufacturer or our Therapeutic Goods Administration has approved. It'll be off-label, et cetera, et cetera. Now, doctors can make that decision in their clinical experience. So once you have the prescription, everything is assumed to be for a therapeutic benefit. But the rules are different state to state. So doctors have a kind of closer eye on that regulation, whether it's therapeutic or not, in different states.
Now, in New South Wales, I believe prescriptions can last 6 months, but in Victoria and Queensland, it's 12. Does that mean patients in some states can effectively double their treatments from one consult?
I'm not sure if you can actually double the volume, as it were, but they last longer. So if I had a prescription, you know, issued 9 months ago in Victoria, I could continue to have it, you know, have the benefit of obtaining the medicine for a longer period than you could in New South Wales. Now, that actually might affect volume depending on whether it's a continually, whether the prescription is able to be updated. In other words, whether it can be kind of a repeat. But that would depend on whether it's a repeat or not.
Now, we spoke earlier just about those parties where people are getting Botox. Mm. How do the regulators, I suppose, deal with those kinds of situations?
Well, since they're not part of the health profession, anyone who is kind of hosting a Botox party and maybe obtained Botox from some, you know, dubious source, maybe online or something like that, off the back of a truck. I hope not. But if that's happening, then the regulators of the health profession can't do anything because these people are presumably not health professionals at all. So what has to happen is that the state health departments, and they've got specialist units for poisons and other drugs, they have to swoop in and find those purveyors, unlicensed purveyors, and they can civilly prosecute them and seek a fine, or maybe even, depending on the circumstances, there may be more onerous penalties in different states.
Do you think a single national law would make things clearer, or are professional guidelines, I suppose, a stronger way to keep people safe?
It's a very it's a question that's been in the news a lot recently, including not just in cosmetics, but in the IVF sector. You've seen this that debate as well, because there's been some issues in one state and it wouldn't have been a problem in another. So this disuniformity in healthcare around Australia, It's part of our constitutional framework. The Commonwealth Government doesn't have any powers to make laws about health. That's why during COVID you saw variation state to state with the public health orders. So it was kind of left to the states as a bargaining chip when federation occurred. They said, oh, we can keep education and health if you join up to the centralised government that we now call Australia. So it's been a structural problem for more than 100 years. I think uniformity has its place and its benefits, but in a way, on this matter, the health professional regulations have taken charge and taken the lead. We've only just got those new regulations at the start of September, and so I think it's worth seeing how they go. They may manage to do the work that's required. If in 1 or 2 years nothing has changed, then I think the uniformity argument should arise again.
Now, Chris, I suppose for anyone thinking about getting Botox or fillers, what's the best way to protect ourselves and make sure we're in safe hands? Obviously not going to a party.
Yeah, I think it's one of the difficulties with the health professional regulation system is that you really have to complain against a practitioner to see the regulator take action, because the regulator doesn't know everything and can't find difficulties unless the consumer or the patient reports them. The problem with the complaint system is that you only do that once you've had or encountered harm. And so in terms of proactive management of harm, you can basically ask your practitioner how long they've been administering, dermal fillers or Botox, whether they've just entered the industry or whether they've waited the 12 months as they're required. And you could probably do this quite conversationally without, being a difficult customer, but you definitely should keep your wits about you. You can read the ARPRA guidelines, and you can basically, police the health practitioner yourself by seeing if they comply with the guidelines in the way that they're doing things. They should have a good conversation with you about what your aims are when you're receiving the treatment, such as whether what your expectations are. And the practitioner should also say, if the expectations are really, really high, this is going to transform me, transform my life, resolve all of my self-esteem issues. The practitioner should probably say, well, maybe we're not going to get there with this particular treatment, because that's a bigger and issue. They're the kinds of things that practitioners are supposed to do under the new guidelines, have a very detailed informed consent procedure. If a practitioner is not discussing that with you, the red flag should be up, because you really want the health professionals to act like these, like you're in a consultation and getting all of the information about risks that you are concerned to get.
Chris, great to chat with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. That was Chris Rudge, lecturer in law at the University of Sydney.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.